session number 13945, reel 4.
Mr. Davenport, reel 4.
Well, on that, another patrol, the next patrol, I believe it was, that again we went up and to the minefield, laid the mines in the shipping lane, and we carried on our patrol. This was the general practice, through the Lombok Straits to the minefield, lay the mines and then on patrol. And of course, between times, we'd be making signals back to the commander of Task Force 71, which was the whole of the operations came under him, and the British depot ship down at Fremantle to inform them of the situation. So as we pressed on this next patrol, we did sight a ship there called the Shinko Maru, and it was near Bawayan Island. And they, we torpedoed this ship, and the escort immediately counterattacked with depth charges. We were in shallow water. Now, the shallow water was, I would say, maybe 66 feet. We were in shallow water there, and each attack was like giant hammer blows. When the submarine was laid on the bottom after the attack, the escort would come over and you could hear the rumbling of the ship or the escort coming over. And just before it came over, because we were lying on the bottom and in shallow water, the stern, our stern lifted up and then went down, and this escort went over like an express train, and then a few seconds later these giant hammer blows, and the submarine was shook from the depth charges exploded over the boat. The stern was lifted out, as I said, right out, and then slammed down again each time. The scene was pretty awful. There was bodies lying around all over the place because of the stunning effect that it had. I was in the control room. I saw a shower of light bulbs coming down and the place in darkness. There was hissing and hissing noises from escaping gases in the equipment around me. There was water escaping from broken valves, and I could hear people shouting orders to one or two of their comrades to do this and do that. It was in Dutch, I can't remember what was said now, but I remember one of the officers giving the order to remain calm and keep their voices down, and so on. Now, of course, at that time, it was about 4:30 at night when we started, the attack started on the ship. So that by 5:30, we had actually attacked the ship with the torpedoes, and the escort had come over us. And little did we know that we'd never get out of this quickly. We thought we'd be able to lay there for a short while and get away, but not at all. Darkness was coming over at that time of the day. It was getting dark up top. We thought, well, we'll use the darkness to get away. But every time the captain thought about surfacing, the escort would come roaring back and drop more depth charges. We could also hear depth charges being dropped distant, so it looked as if he was not sure where we were. But he certainly had a bullseye on one or two occasions and caused an awful lot of damage. The shattering of the glass, the escaping air, made large noises, as I mentioned already, and there was leaking hydraulic oil all over the place. The engine room had to be evacuated, and also the after torpedo room. They came through and they shut their bulkhead door. And after that, we were getting messages that in the forward battery compartment, there was water pouring in from a gland, which is a gland surrounding what we used to call the Christmas tree. Now, this was in the forward battery compartment, and this equipment and unit controlled the moving of torpedo tubes on the upper deck under the casing. Not torpedoes right forward, no. These torpedoes were just forward of the gun under the casing. To control them and to train them to the port side or train them to the starboard side, all the equipment was down below. But of course, it had to go through a hole in the pressure hull, didn't it? And that was the weakness of it. And of course, during this attack, the gland, this gland that went right round, was weakened and water poured in. And of course, we were then in the situation where we had salt water coming in into a battery compartment. They immediately organised a tarpaulin to go right round and for the water to be redirected down into the bilges. There was quite a stench coming up now at this time. And the crew itself, especially the torpedo men and engineers, they got round this Christmas tree, which I mentioned earlier, and were tightening up all the knots that they could possibly get at. And they carried out all repairs and eventually stopped most of the leaks. Of course, they were in a bad situation there and a bad situation in the engine room. Where the gyro compass had packed up completely and a periscope was completely shattered. Air in the control room where I was very bad, and they told us to get out of the control room, and some officers went into the conning tower, which was a bit higher up, you see. So one or two managed to get up there, and we went into the wardroom. Now, my job was to prepare to abandon the boat, because I didn't think really we were going to get out of it anyway. But my job was to prepare to abandon the boat and get rid of and destroy all the CBs and anything to do with crypto and ciphering. Now, when we were on board the as a liaison rating, our job, apart from visual signalling with lamps, we also had to and were trained in ciphering and coding. And the one thing you don't want to do is to let the ciphers and codes get into the enemy's hands. So you have to destroy them. And this was one of the most important things. You must destroy them. We had eyeleted bags. So you put all the books, heavy books, which were lead weighted, by the way, into these eyeleted bags, ready to dispose them. Other things you had to do was some of the crypto machines, as we call them today, or coding and ciphering machines, as we call them, you could not possibly lift them. So what you had to do was get a hammer and break them up so that they would not be able to get anything from the machines themselves if they were recovered. So you had to think of everything possible in destroying all confidential and secret books in the boat. That was myself, telegraphists, and under the orders of the British naval liaison officer, which we had on board, called Sub-Lieutenant Cowans, I think his name was. After a while, of course, the submarine now had been lying in this battered condition on the boat, on the floor bed, seabed, and a lot of people were getting very tired. and it looked as if we would only got one chance, and that is blow the main ballast tag and get up on the surface. Well, the captain ordered the engineer officer to check on the state of the engine room. Well, they thought, well, let's see if we can get through. Well, they had a bit of a job getting through because they couldn't open the bulkhead door. The pressure in the boat had built up so much that it was impossible to open the bulkhead door into the engine room. So the only way we could do it would be to surface and open the upper lid, the lid, the hatch at the top of the conning tower, let in some air there, and that would equalise the pressure. And this we did. What we did was we surfaced, and the captain just surfaced sufficient for the conning tower to go up, and he got out, actually had a look around, he could see a couple of ships out there, one that we'd sunk or badly damaged was right over on its side, and there were ships picking up survivors. There was a lot of lights on, searchlights going on, where they were obviously searching for people. But the escort, we thought, was a bit too close, so we thought, well, we better stay down again. So anyway, sufficient to say that they were able to open the engine room watertight door and get into the engine room because the pressure had been equalised. Then they shut the upper lid, and down we went again. We stayed down there, and when they went into the engine room, they found that the engine room was flooded up to the deck. And all this lot, the water was pouring in from damaged valves all round the engine room. And at that time, as I say, it was right up to the deck of the engine room, the deck plates. And that's the flooding from that. Now, all that, of course, had to be pumped out. So the first thing they had to do was get the pumps going. And when they got them going, they were able to pump water out. And gradually got things into a situation where we could surface and probably get the engines going. Meantime, there were all the work was going on possible by a chap called Major Dehan. He was like a warrant officer, electrician. He was working on the compass, and he made a very good job of that. He got the gyro going again. And then about, I'm not sure, but it would be around 11 o'clock at night, I would think, 11 o'clock at night, we surfaced. And at first it was very difficult. The boat was lying at a terrible angle, and we didn't think she'd come up. But she came up. We seemed to be stuck on the bottom, and she came up. And then she seemed to shoot up, and up we came. And after a while, say a while, about 2 or 3 minutes it seemed, well, probably seemed a long time to us because they were trying to get the engines going. Luckily, both engines fired after a fashion, and we were on our way. And with the gyro going, we had a rough idea where we were going, and we started making our way back. Now, I have to say that some of the details of it I'm not quite sure about now, but we were spotted by aircraft, and they had a go at us, but we managed to dive, but almost come up straight away again. We couldn't stay down below. We had problems, so we had to stay on the surface. And we made for Darwin. But we went the long way around for safety because we would have never got through the Lombok Straits. And we got into Darwin. And when we got to Darwin, the divers went down. And the diver came up and he said, you've lost both hydroplanes. You've lost both after hydroplanes, I should say. And your propellers are like two cabbages. And all this was because of the depth charging we got after sinking that ship, which I told you about. And we then stayed there for a few days to do what repairs we could, but very little. And then we took a chance and stayed on the surface and went all the way down to Fremantle. And after Captain SM had inspected the submarine and everybody had listed all the things that had gone wrong, they had even arranged for a firm in Sydney, the other side of Australia, to make new hydroplanes and so on and so forth. The captain said, "We will now put the boat into dock, and we hope to get you ready for sea as soon as possible." Well, it took 10 weeks, I must say, 10 weeks, and before the boat was seaworthy again. So it was in a terrible condition when it arrived from that patrol.
How frightened were you?
Well, I was not frightened at the time. I was more frightened after my head started aching from the terrible blows from the depth charges. I felt very sorry indeed for the older men who seemed to know more about what could go wrong than myself. A lot of them remember it had been their home for 3 or 4 years. They'd never known anything else. They never lived anywhere but on this submarine. They knew every bit of it. It was their home. Here they were being heavily depth charged. The place was being smashed to smithereens. And they themselves, being older than me, were suffering mentally more than I'd ever know. One or two of them broke down during the attack. One of them suggested that we say prayers. The captain said, "If you don't say prayers in your harbour another time, why should you go and say prayers now?" And so on. People had different views about that. It was a very tense time for people. But you see, you have to remember that some of us were not as old as them, and we could try and tried our best to put a more cheerful attitude to it. Now, at one stage, they were thinking we would now have to use our DSEA escape suits. And there were so many in the lockers, not enough for everybody. It's like having our life belts on the ship, but not enough for everybody. I remember a Javanese boy, he came up to me. I think he was a steward, actually. And he said, "You tell me how to put it on and how to work it." And I said, "Where did you get that from?" And he told me it was from a locker in the wardroom, one of the officers it was. I said, "Well, that's all right." So I showed him how to use this. And it had a container which had soda lime in it, in these suits, so that if he breathed that, he should be okay. So I told him and showed him how to use it. And then as you're telling one, so the others are all listening, but there's not enough suits for them all. So you can imagine their thoughts. So, well, we know how it works, but we can't have one. I didn't have one anyway. But there was never enough for them, you see. And I thought, although they'd had basic training in these things, I thought it was not enough to put them at ease. And they were very, very worried about it and how they were going to get out of the submarine. Some of them obviously couldn't swim either, so that was another problem. The other big problem, when he asked me, was I frightened? What I was frightened of and feared of was I'd seen in the Mirror, an Australian paper. It showed you a photograph, which I still have to this day, of an American naval officer kneeling. He's got his hands behind his back and his head bowed. And above him, there is a... above him is a Japanese with a sword about to behead this American submarine officer. And I thought to myself, well, what a wicked race they are. And I thought, good heavens, if I although I could swim, I thought, good heavens, I don't know if I'd ever swim that distance, but if I got picked up, I would hate that, because I'd hate to be taken prisoner by the Japanese. I'd love to be able to think that I could swim somewhere ashore and keep out of the way of the Japanese, hide in the jungle or something like that. But it was the fear of being a prisoner in Japan that was my main worry. So after that patrol, we then had a nice 10 weeks in harbour in Fremantle. We went out on patrol again. It was the same routine, but of this particular case, we called in at Onslow, which is on the west coast of Australia, near Exmouth, the Exmouth Gulf, and there was a refueling base there now, which came onto the Americans, the US Navy, because they had big ocean-going submarines and they needed this extra fuel to take them further. Although in our particular case, unless we were going to certain billets, our normal fuel supply was sufficient to take us there and back in the number of weeks. However, we called there, and then on our way through Lombok Straits, we were again attacked by the patrol vessels. But this time, we had heard that the Americans were now going through the Lombok Straits on the surface, in broad daylight. This was a new tactic, and they were using their guns to fire back and counterattack the submarine chasers. I know very little about their success, but it did make us feel a lot more confident that probably we were getting on top. However, we got through the Lombok Strait once again and up to the area for mines, and we laid our minefield as usual. It seemed that there were very few targets these days. What a ship in their world, they would hug the coastline where there were shallow waters and most unfavourable for submarines operating. It was during this patrol that we sighted a large battle cruiser or a heavy cruiser, and we did attack that. It took us a long while to wait for the attack to take place, and the best we could say was that we got one hit on that cruiser.
Any details you remember about that attack?
I can't really recall anything other than firing. They fired four torpedoes, and the four destroyers they had came along searching for the submarine that had fired it, and they got nowhere near us at all. We just went deep. When we come up, we saw that we had made a hit. She had slowed down and slewed round, but they managed to get that cruiser back into Singapore, and they put it into dock into Singapore dockyard. Eventually, it came out again, and I believe it was sunk by aircraft. We also had a few skirmishes with very small coasters that were equipped with guns. So apart from that, the patrol was quite uneventful. We always had aircraft overhead. There were always contacts with small ships, but there was nothing really to go for on that particular patrol. As I said earlier, that targets were getting fewer and fewer, and there were quite a lot of submarines now operating by the British and the American forces, and so there were fewer and fewer targets. Sometimes the mines we had laid had obviously had their effect. Quite a number of ships were sunk by these mines, and we had reports of these ships being sunk. We picked up the reports and they came back to the headquarters, where we were quite pleased to hear that we'd had some success with mines as well. Now, we got back from that patrol and we then went into Fremantle, and the next patrol we were to go on was on the 25th of June 1945. Well, as you see, the war in Europe was over. Everything was now pouring out to the Far East. Ships were all coming out. Aircraft carriers, the British Home Fleet, was now coming out. Ships from South Africa coming across. Ships from Australia were moving up into the Philippines areas. So gradually, the pressure was now on the Japanese. We were pushing them further and further back. So, as I say, we went on patrol on the 25th of June, 1945. We called in at Onslow and refueled there, and then we sailed again on patrol. But, unfortunately, having laid our mines and then on our patrol, we were then really supposed to be going on to the Philippines to deliver some dummy mines and other stores to a British depot ship which had gone up to that area. That was to be our task, was to lay our mines, part patrol, and then part continue and take up these stores. Well, we unfortunately ran aground then on a reef called Ladd Reef, which is part of the Spratly Islands on the northwest coast of Borneo. The South China Sea, in other words. And you would see on a map, it is midway between Vietnam and Borneo. We ran aground at 15 knots. And the boat was hard and fast on the ground.